All right, guys, I've been waiting for this one. Have you started holiday shopping yet? If you're like me, 2020 has felt like the longest year, yet here we are, getting ready for the holidays. And just like most everything else, even shopping looks a little bit different, and that's where Sally Sue Collections comes in. They're an online boutique with personalized goods to fit your taste and style, and there's plenty of fun and sassy items in stock and ready to ship. Mugs to tumblers to shirts and hats and gifts for our amazing teachers and frontline workers, SallySueCollections.com has you covered. Give the gift of thoughtfulness this year and stand out with fun and unique items, and you'll also be supporting a local business. And that's what this whole thing is about. Shop local, support local. With SallySueCollections.com, your shopping experience is 100% contactless. And keep in mind that due to the volume of online shopping this year, orders are anticipated to be high. So what does that mean for you? Shop early and then kick back and enjoy your time with friends and family. There's never been a better year to plan ahead, shop safely, and find those special gifts for your loved ones, friends, and colleagues. And that's where SallySueCollections.com comes in. Visit them. SallySueCollections.com. Get in there, get your gifts, and have a rocking end of the year. All right, guys, you know that this episode of the podcast is brought to you by Hepias. Hepias is your number one place to go for premium CBD products at a fraction of the cost. This is perfect for any first-time user and for the veteran user. There's no THC. It's locally sourced and third-party tested, so you don't have to worry about paying for any fancy celebrities or a drug test. These guys have something for everybody, and I personally enjoy their products. In fact, my favorite one's the Sleep Aid, so go check them out, hepiasmed.com. HEPIUSMED.com. Right in time for the holiday seasons. Again, go check them out, happiestmed.com, and have fun. Okay, you know what time it is. It's time for me to introduce my next guest, guys. And this time, I had the pleasure of interviewing Sam Kane, who is the author of the new book called The Pilgrim's Soul. He is an author out of Louisiana. He grew up in Colorado, but we met because his book was fascinating, first of all. His book is about, you know, how we deal with death. I mean, a very heavy subject in our culture today. But we had an amazing conversation about it. He wrote an amazing book. It is fiction, but the story is incredible and based on, you know, the thoughts that we have every day. And he really puts together an amazing story that helps us think. So without further ado, please welcome Sam Kane. You can follow him on social media. He's on Instagram. His Instagram is at Sam Kane, K-A-N-E, writer, Sam Kane writer. And on Facebook, Sam Kane author. Like I said, we had an amazing conversation. You guys are really going to enjoy this one. So please welcome Sam Kane and let me know what you think. Welcome, everybody. This is Dalton Jensen, and you're tuning into The Thinking Project. Good to go?
Absolutely. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm Sam.
Oh, nice to meet you, Sam. I'm Dalton, and it's super nice to meet you. I'm super glad we get to do this, man.
I'm excited.
Yeah, yes, sir. Well, I'll just jump right into it. You're writing a book. You've already written the book, right?
I've already written it, yes.
Remind me of the title.
The Pilgrim's Soul.
The Pilgrim's Soul. Yes, that's right. Was it the publisher who I was talking to?
Sage's Tower.
Yeah, when she introduced us, she was talking about the book, and I was like, holy cow, that is something that I would like to talk about. So why don't you give us a little background of what the book is about and like why you wrote it?
Absolutely. So it actually started as a conversation between a friend of mine, which was, how could we make an argument for the continuation of consciousness after death, right? Lighthearted material. So from there, right, we just kind of started going back and forth about this idea of perhaps we can separate the idea of a thing from the actual thing. And if we can get that, our minds wrapped around that, then maybe we could also have this experience where we as people become more than human, right? Because to be human is to, you know, follow your instinctual drive to eat and sleep, et cetera, et cetera. But we also do these amazing things, like we're noble and we have like amazing morals. We transcend the basic animal impulse. So what happens to our minds when we do that? Our argument was, well, maybe we create the soul that way. Maybe we create this continuation of consciousness. And then where does that go whenever, you know, humanity ceases to be? And that's where the book started. And so it was just more of an exploration of this idea of like, can the human spirit continue even when everything else ceases?
Wow. Yeah. That, yeah. Right. Lighthearted material. Right, man. So I'm curious, first, all the questions come to my head because this is a topic that I really like. You know, I like the philosophy behind it all. And even some of the theological differences between people. Right. But I'm curious for you, where did that idea come from? You know, walk me through why you were even impressed to write a book about, you know, does consciousness continue or how can we get it to continue?
Well, it's twofold. One of them is because more than anything else, I think that humanity needs to be reminded in a way that we are connected, right? There are things that we will always have that we have to endure. Like we have to live, we have to progress, and eventually we all have to cease existence. And yes, we separate ourselves into these little camps, like politically, socially, even religiously. I'm not going to get too deep into that. Obviously, I don't want to make anybody uncomfortable. Sure. But at the end, we still have to go through these universal things. We have to live, we have to experience, and we have to die, right? So why not talk about and tell stories about things that all humanity must endure? And that's the cool thing about stories, is they provide us the opportunity to seek comfort in things that we can't control, right? And we can't control the fact that we're all going to end up not being around anymore. So why not create a story that at least makes it plausible that maybe we can keep going? Maybe there's something else. Maybe there's another step. And from there, I guess it's just selfish because I want to believe that this isn't just it, right? There's this idea that, you know, after you and I cease existence on this plane, that there's something else there, that there's something we can see, something else we can experience. And then from that kind of speculation, I built the book.
Wow. So it's your story of how this all progresses.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy, man. So it's a, correct me if I'm wrong, because I got a little bit of the kit and everything, but it's a fiction book, right?
Yes, it's literary fiction.
Sweet. Okay. No, I like it though, because a lot of people get bored with those. Like I personally like the nonfiction, like the philosophy books, but I know some people don't. They can get, you know, so it's just not some people's cup of tea. Sometimes it goes too deep than they want to go, or maybe they don't understand it as well. Like I'll be honest, I don't understand a lot of the stuff. So I have to reread things a few times and find a mentor and things, you know, but I think people like those kind of books that tell a story and that highlight these principles in that kind of way, right? So what do you try to teach throughout the book? Like what are some of the main lessons and how do you weave that into a story?
So I don't really want to teach lessons. You know, I don't have that much ego of I'm going to tell you how to live. That's insane. You know, we all have to experience our own things. But you did hit the nail on the head with stories. I love mythology. And it's really interesting that these stories about gods and goddesses and demons and half goat, half man creatures existed and continue for thousands of years. Like, why is that? And the reason is because of exactly what you said. It has these messages and these stories about how to progress through life, right? How to love, how to deal with things in a noble fashion, like how to grow as a man or a woman, you know? And it's just really cool to kind of add my own couple of words to that cosmic, you know, tapestry. And so one of the things more than anything else that I really like to explore is this idea that we can transcend the basic human self, right? We always get so wrapped up in how do I look? You know, who perceives me as cool or interesting? Does this person find me attractive, right? But at the end of the day, we also have to contend with this idea of where does my spirit feel fulfilled? Where can I actually enrich myself as a human being with my mind? And so allegorically, of course, this is a story of somebody who goes through that, right? It's all right, all identifiers and markings are largely stripped away. You are just your consciousness. What does that mean? Who are you as a person, right? And so in a society that is so wrapped up in the way that we're perceived by everybody else, when you strip that away and you can just be two people, you find some really interesting things to talk about.
I think so, man. I think that's, but you know, you were saying during this whole, you know, in our consumerism kind of trap that we're in, right? It can be hard to get on that same wavelength, right, as another person. So how do you, like, you know, because I like that idea, you know, you strip away everything and you just have me and you, and now we're just going to talk, right? And there's no egos, there's no, you know, we both realize that we're striving for the same object of that truth, whatever that is, right? And mm-hmm. and we're cool with both of us not being, you know, not having all of that, and so now we're going to have a conversation. I love that idea. How do you paint that picture in your book?
So the book begins with something that people don't want to talk about, and that is death. The first chapter is actually the main character dying, right? And so what it does is it forces the reader to evaluate their own, you know, finite existence, right? And so one of the things that we do as human beings.
That's a good one. I mean, it's great. I think more people should.
Yeah. There's a collection of monks that actually meditate 30 minutes a day on their own death. And as a result, they're considered to be some of the happiest people because it grounds them in the fact that this is not permanent, right?
And so what
I did was, is I was like, all right, we usually have all of these crazy character arcs and these like intricacies. And no, the first chapter, the dude dies. And as a result, we're forced to kind of all come together in this moment of people who have to accept the fact that we'll pass. And then that allows real conversation to take place.
Yeah, man. I think, well, I have, you know, I'm very stoic in my, you know, philosophy. And so, yeah, I even have a coin that I carry around that says, you know, memento mori, like, you know,
I have
that
on my neck. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's just a good, yeah. And when you do it the right way, you know, you brought up a good point. Like when you do it the right way, when you approach death as just a part of life, right? Like it's not good or bad. It just is what it is kind of thing. Yeah. You do start to prioritize things a lot differently. Right.
Absolutely.
And it's so interesting. What made you want to, cause it's so funny, right? Like killing off the main character, and maybe not that that's not the right phrase, but I use it for lack of a better one. Right. But that's interesting. What made you want to take that route? I mean, I know that we want to get people comfortable with like the thought of dying, but then how does it progress? Like, how do you manage that in the book?
All right. Stick with me here.
All right.
I actually did it because I wanted to create a sense of hope. Right. And I know that sounds so strange because it's like, okay, the dude died. Why? Like, how is this a hopeful scenario? Well,
right.
The hope is that as you read the book, you'll realize that the experiences that Simon, the main character, had actually prepared him and his soul to continue on past just basic existence, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea is to instill hope in the reader that like if you experience enough, if you are true to yourself enough, if you live in this honest and noble manner, there's a chance that your consciousness can continue on. And like this isn't the end.
Right.
And so the hope was to A, get people comfortable with the fact that yes, you will pass. Because again, you and I are having this really honest, really cool conversation that's grounded in the fact that you and I are eventually going to pass on, right? We kind of talked about it.
Yeah.
Again, keeping it nice and light.
Right, right. And,
but see, then it's like, well, what if there's something else? And so that kind of grounding in hope really made the book a lot of fun to write, because I thought that if at least one person feels hopeful and like has a good conversation about this material after my book is done, I've done my job.
Yeah, it's so crazy, man. And we can, and I like talking about this, so I want to get your idea because now I want the book and now I want to read the book. But I'm just curious, you know, what got you to the point where you were comfortable with the fact that we have an expiration date? And we don't know when the expiration date is.
Sure. There's a couple of instances in my life, but I'll give this one. I was dropped off in a bush plane in the middle of the Alaskan wilderness, and I was supposed to go on this really nice couple day fishing trip, right? The problem is that our guide didn't tell us that the area had flooded more than it had since 1986. So what we thought was like these light, small waters was actually category 5 rapids. And the problem is we run into them, right? And I have my waders on. Now for those fishermen amongst us, once water fills up your waders, you sink to the bottom.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I hit these rapids and I'm just working and I'm staying afloat and my raft is okay. And then I just see this white mist, and white mist, as everybody knows, is a waterfall. So I hit these steps and I hit one rock and it turns my raft to the side, and I hit this other rock and it flips my raft over. My waders fill, I hit my head on a rock and I sink.
Oh, no.
So it's this weirdest sensation because I'm stuck in this water. I can't escape. I have this moment in my life in that those couple of seconds where I'm like, this is it. It's done. There's nothing you can do. It's time to go. And there's like a strange moment of clarity that you receive where it's just like, all right, you know, I wish I could have done more, but here we are. And then something happened, and I don't know if it was just like chance or if it was something else, but I managed to get hit in such a way by the moving current that I actually popped up and grabbed onto the side of the raft, still weighted by my waders, and I escaped and could breathe. And it was at that moment that I realized, I was about 21 years old, that this is not permanent. Right. Mm. And so from there, it really altered my perspective, and it altered the way in which I viewed the world. I viewed relationships. I viewed things that are important and that matter, because when I was sitting under that water and thinking that my lungs were about to give out and it was about to be over, like, you don't think about the coolest new phone you got, or you don't think about your shoes. Right. All you think about is your family and your experiences. And that's actually the start, the germination of the idea, I think.
That's great, dude. And you're right. I've had similar experiences. And it's weird when you talk about these things with people who view death a little differently, or maybe they don't want to think about it because it's hard to understand. Like, I understand, like when you said there was like that moment of clarity, I got that. Like, I knew exactly what that was, because it really does, you know, and clarity, perspective, like whatever you want to call it, is real. And it's like, and it's the craziest thing to try to describe. But for you writing the book, there was that necessity of like, you know, I need to get this message out. If I just help one person, you know, very noble cause to write the book. But you wrote it because, you know, we all have the same question when we're having these conversations. And that's, you know, what makes people so uncomfortable with the idea that you have an expiration date? I know it's not, like when you ask that question, it's like, well, it's obvious, man. Everybody, you know what I mean? But it's just a weird thing.
Yeah. There's a philosophical quandary, right? Where if you are afraid of death, you should be as afraid of your own birth, because you have control of neither, right?
Right, right.
So it begs the question, of course. So it's like, well, yeah, but I didn't know I was being born, right? I didn't know that this was happening. My brain wasn't there.
Sure.
But you don't know when you're going to die. That argument is still the same, right? I might walk out of my office right now and call it, and it's done.
Yeah.
So what people do, and I'm so guilty of this, is they love to be distracted from things that matter, from the fact that we're going to cease, because we're the only species that we know that really knows that we have an expiration date, right? So we're the
That's
only
fair.
Ones.
Yeah.
And so what we do is some people embrace it and they're like, oh, well, I'm going to make things that matter. I'm going to make art. I'm going to, you know, create this new invention, or I'm going to, you know, figure out truth to the best of my ability. And other people are like, no, I'm going to distract myself. I'm going to find something that keeps me away from these serious questions. And the problem with that is we end up living these half lives without full examination. And then by the time it is the end, we just have regret. So why not get it out the way?
You know? Right. No, I'm with you. I love that idea that it just gives you that sense of urgency that, you know, I can do something now about what I have. And because we may not get that later. Right?
Right.
I love that. I love that idea. When were you first like introduced to this idea that you could write the book, that it would sell? I mean, what got you interested in writing?
So I've always loved telling stories, right? Since I was young. Yeah. I actually didn't think that this book was going to sell. I'm not going to lie to you. So I'm an English teacher, and one of the things that I really expect out of my students and my colleagues is that we don't just teach, we do, right? So I had this idea. I had this thing I wanted to explore, this philosophical quandary. And I was like, you know what? I need to prove to myself, to my students, that I can go through this crafting as well, right? Yeah. And so I went through it. It was amazing. I love creating the different characters. I love the research aspect of it, you know. Yeah. And whenever Simon reaches the next place, it's this plane called Dara. And there are people there that have also transcended the basic. And so, like, you get to meet all these historical characters that have also transcended, like, just what it means to be basically alive. And so you get to interact. But in order to, like, make that believable, I had to do a lot of research. Like, there's characters from ancient Greece. There's, like, the Songhai Empire and the Mali country in Africa that is, like, shows themselves. There's, like, people in the American South in the 19th century. There's all these different areas. And in order to make these characters believable and their stories matter, I had to really dig in, or else it just would be like smack of inauthenticity and it would destroy the book.
Yeah.
And so when I started just really researching and digging and investing time and then getting my story to actually make sense, that's when I was like, okay, I think I can actually make this book work. And so I pitched it to, I got it edited, pitched it to Sages Tower Publishing, my publishing house that works with me, and they picked it up and they've just been amazing. They've really believed in the process. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, but
that's why I went there.
Yeah, heck yeah, man. That's great. So I was actually going to, I kind of want to go into this research part a little bit more and then ask a couple other questions, because I love interviewing authors, because that whole creative process for me is really cool. When you're making, not just, you know, I mean, I like the guys who make articles. Those are really fun because that's a different kind of style of writing. But the people who make novels and these books, like making it flow and making it consistent, like that just like boggles my mind. Like, you know what I mean? I really respect it. I know that I don't have that kind of mind, but I really respect the craft. And for you, during the research process, what was that like? Like, how many hours of research did you do? How many characters did you research? I mean, what all went into that?
So it's like a slippery slope. Luckily, I work with some really cool authors and some people in the publishing world. Like, there's some books coming out. Andrea Nilsson, Sarah Sabucci, they got some speculative fiction and some fantasy coming out. It's going to be really awesome. But for me, it's like this. So let's say I decide, what's a historical period that you really like, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, man, that's such a good one. I mean, historical period, probably that whole like Roman period.
Right. And
the
so
Roman period, yeah.
One of my characters, one of the antagonists, is actually from ancient Rome, right? And so I pick a character and I'm like, all right, this is the area. This is the time period that they're from. The problem is that now you have to research, like, when does the Colosseum get created? When was Rome no longer a republic? When did it become an empire? When was it just a kingdom, right? What infrastructure was in place whenever this character died, right? Because what happens is that if you're just, like, start throwing out, like, Colosseum and Gladiator and this stuff, my character's time period, none of that existed. So then it starts to slowly fall apart. And then that's the worst feeling as a reader is finding a character that's not believable, or finding a plot point that's just like a giant gaping hole. It destroys the whole book. Like, you could have such a cool idea and concept, but that's great for conversation. That's not great for a novel. So I spent months researching each time period, like each area. Like, I had like, I was like a crazy guy in a hotel room. I had maps and I had family trees, right?
And for example,
I had a family tree just so I could say in passing that a character had a cousin that they believed in, right? And so, I mean, obviously I don't expect people to dive in that much to my character arcs, but if they did, I want them to know that it's there.
Right, that I did the research.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's important, though, because you get a lot of the story, because so many more stories can come up, especially when you're talking about like this idea, the whole premise of your book, knowing those characters' backstories and like kind of setting them up just gives like that whole consistency in the story. And I really like that. Like, that's something that, like I said before, really like gets me going, because when you have consistency and you can be like, oh yeah, you know, this person, you know, his cousin or whatever, right? The family trees all match and everything. It starts to like make more sense. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, well, you can start to see it as a real thing, you know, like, hey, maybe that actually, you know, because for me, when I read stories like that, because I've read a few of books like that, right? Mm-hmm. For me, it's like, hey, why not though? You know, and it gives me like this real idea that I can take that story and make it real, because everything in the book that I'm reading is consistent.
And since it's a series, right, then mm-hmm. those characters are going to be revisited, and there's like time jumps and things like that. Wow. Not too much, because that gets weird. But
yeah.
The character needs to remain consistent. And one of the most fun things that I had actually was having two characters interact with each other from completely different cultural time periods, right? Oh, so wow. We have like a modern day guy, Simon, has to interact with a Greek philosopher from the 5th century BC, right? What does that look like, right? Yeah, how does he interact with his friends, his family? How does he interact with like different groups of people versus what Simon is told is normal? Because culturally, you know, we're very different from 20 years ago, let alone 2000. And right. So that was just so fun to like make people from like the antebellum South interact with a Roman general. Like what would happen? You know,
yeah,
and that was really interesting to me.
And you said that those kind of interactions happen in your book frequently.
They do, yes.
So how do you craft those interactions?
So it has to remain as organic as possible, right? And so
right.
You have to think, what is the thing that connects all of humanity together, right? We desire to be social in one way or the other. Yeah. We love community. And so what happens was I created these villages and towns and cities in this next plane that are based on like people who have like common ideologies, not necessarily like historical timepieces, right?
Yeah.
So if you're a moral person, your whole life was based on ethics, you're going to go to Valorin. If you're somebody who's really into like community and emotional connection, you're going to go to a place called Elysium. And so your soul, your consciousness, your spirit is drawn to these places based upon who you are fundamentally. And whether or not it's time period based or not, people started interacting and connecting and forming relationships. There's a person from the Middle Ages who's a French chef, considered to be one of the first French gourmet chefs of all time, called Talleyrand. And he has best friends with basically an alcoholic from 15th century England. So it's really fun.
Yeah. Holy cow. And those, I mean, how do those go in your head? Like when you're creating these conversations with these two different people, I mean, mm-hmm. how do you approach that conversation to the reader? Like, you know, you go over the main points, you know, the conversation starts to happen organically, but what kind of messages are you hoping come across in those interactions?
So I guess I'll answer it in two ways. Like, for example, you and I are just having a conversation, right? Yeah. It would be incredibly weird if before I walked up to you, I said, my name is Sam Kane. I am from this time period. I am this old, right? People don't do that. We just start talking. So I had to make it as organic as possible while also making them feel grounded in history. And the other thing I wanted to let people know more than anything else, whenever we're having all these different time periods and different people, different languages, different cultures, mm-hmm. is that though we present as very different, in truth, we are incredibly similar. You know, we all want love. We all want connection. We all want ways in which to make ourselves have meaning and purpose. And that, you know, minutia makes it different. Like created a medium that allows people to like talk about their businesses, talk about their ideas and books. And that's amazing. And I've decided that I want to make my meaning in writing books.
Yeah.
And so at the same point, you and I are both looking for meaning and purpose and like validation in our lives. And that feeling needs to translate whenever my characters interact too. It's like, yes, you're a Greek philosopher. Yes, you are a doctor from Germany, but you still are driving, looking for meaning and connection. And that was really fun to play with.
Wow. Yeah. Holy cow. Cause it's, and to see the differences, right. And I'm sure that's kind of why you go modern to ancient and these kind of different gaps, because I mean, it's interesting to think that we had a lot of the same problems, as like people in ancient times as now,
right.
But the way we viewed them was different, and culturally it's going to be different. And so to get those kind of clashes of these different time periods and different cultures and different regions, because I mean, it might, and regionally we handle things differently, right? Yep. Western societies, very analytical, very architectural, right? Then you go to the East, and while those things are still important, they're more, they're more symbolic. They're more, they think with, their guts and things like that, which is, and all really good things. And I'm not saying like that's the hard line, right? But generally that's what you see, right? Because for me, it's hard to read some of the Eastern books, even though I've kind of trained myself to do that, because I'm still very like analytical. And so I got to break that to understand some of these things. And so it's just really cool to kind of see how all of those connect, and you learn like crazy lessons from people outside of your sphere of influence, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the same idea of the East and the West, right? To your point, the Western ideology, it's largely based on that Greek philosophy of thinking, which is like A, B, C, straight line. Yeah. Whereas the Eastern philosophies are much more circular, like the concepts of reincarnation. Right. It all comes back together. It comes back to one, right? But again, take both of those things away. I mean, both of those methodologies away. It is a way in which to derive meaning and purpose. It is a way in which to explain. And so one of my characters from book two is he's a Chinese philosopher who was famously expelled from his kingdom because he did not believe in reincarnation. So one of the things is everybody makes fun of him because they're literally reincarnated in this world. And they're like, ha, you're wrong. And so like his entire eternity is people making fun of his philosophy.
Oh, jeez.
Right. But, it's just stuff like that that's really fun and interesting to play with. But to your point, when you strip all of these, identities away and these cultural norms away, what is it that's left, right? Purpose and meaning. And that's just really cool to explore on a universal framework.
Yeah. And how do you, I guess what I'm trying to say is we get our purpose and meaning a lot from a lot of these like identity markers, right? And so when you take away all these ideologies and these identities and things like that, you are left with purpose and meaning that has come from these other external things. And so the challenge then is, right, is so what matters and what doesn't, right? Like what do we care about and what do we not care about? And I guess you're trying to get to that point in every character to find all the commonalities and to just explore those different ideas and obstacles. Is that right?
Absolutely. So much, like you hit the nail on the head so well. Yeah. So much of who we believe we are is largely derived from like our culture or our family or what people have told us we are. Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's interesting whenever you get to a point where it's like, okay, let's remove all of that. What is it that actually matters? What is the thing that is actually going to make my soul enriched? And for people, it's different.
Yeah.
But it's also largely similar in a lot of ways, right? Like the transcendent ideas. And it's just really cool because there's only so many ways that people can approach their lives, right? But they're all, it's just really interesting to explore all of those ways in which people see the world. And it's just been really fun doing it.
Yeah. I think you're on the right track for sure. Because a lot of people, but a lot of people, it's hard for us to realize that, right? Like we're all human at a very basic level and we're all trying to do the same thing. And that's a crazy concept for, for a lot of people to get. And you know, what's funny, as we're talking about this, I feel like that's one of the reasons people are uncomfortable with the idea of death is because they don't really know what to do with it. Like we don't talk about it very often, as at least as much as we should. And so when we get scared like that, a lot of people, you know, this fight or flight instinct. And so when you were talking about like stripping away instincts and ideologies, that was one of the things that I thought about. I was like, what if we didn't have that, right? What if we didn't, like, I know it's biologically in us, but what if we could strip that away and view things from without that one of those like primitive instincts of fight or flight? And I was like, holy cow, man, that'd be kind of weird. Like, what would you do? I don't know, man.
And it's so weird because as human beings, this is actually really new. People used to see death very frequently. I mean, I'm glad that we have medical advances and that's not what I'm saying, but death was actually your companion for quite some time. And so what it was is people came to terms with it very early. And so they derived meaning very early. They understood that they weren't going to be here forever. So it was just a part of life. And it was only very recently that we're like separating, like even look at what we do with our elders, with our old people, our wise ones. We put them in nursing homes and we're like, we don't want to look at you age and fade, even though, you know, on your backs, you have built this place that I take advantage of and I enjoy to the fullest. You don't get to enjoy it anymore because you scare me because you're over here. Right.
Right. And well, yeah, man.
So this separation of like our own truth is a chronic problem in our society. It's terrible.
Well, it's interesting to look at some of the statistics, and I don't have them quotable offhand, but one of them is like the over time, as we've started to live longer, there was almost like, and obviously, you know, one of the fallacies is correlation is not causation, right?
Right.
But it's just interesting. It's an interesting pattern that I thought was cool to look at of the longer we start to live, the less our happiness was. Right. And obviously, again, like I'm not saying correlation is causation, but what I'm saying is like the longer we live, like there is something special about knowing that I don't have that much time, however much time that is. Right. And being able to make the most of that and to be happy every second because I know, you know what I mean? Because I know my life expectancy, I know the lifespan and things like that. And it's obviously an idea that I haven't like totally gone into, but like I said, it's just fun to like play in my head with.
Well, that's the idea though, right? Is that life expectancy and happiness don't need to fade as one goes up and the other should go down. What has happened instead is that as we continue on our life, we want to look away from things that make us uncomfortable, things that are going to lead to our suffering. And that's actually the wrong kind of logic. What we need to do is look at it right in the face, accept the fact that this is what will happen to me eventually, embrace it and celebrate it. And I can almost guarantee that people become happier because of it. Think of all the times that you procrastinate because you think there's always more time, right?
Yeah. Like,
you know what? I'm going to not talk to that person. I'm going to not, you know, try to write the book. I'm going to not do because I'll have it later. I'm going to play my game or I'm going to, you know,
sit do whatever. And watch
whatever you, right? But instead, if you're forced to be like, no, look at the old people, look what they've accomplished, and this will be you at some point. What do you want to think about as you sit in that chair? And I think your happiness goes up because you're no longer allowed to just sit around and be like, you know what? It'll happen later.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and there is something special that the Eastern philosophies have gotten right that was lost in the Western philosophies. I personally feel like was lost. And that's this idea that like we want to avoid any kind of suffering or pain. And when these Eastern philosophies teach that that's very sacred, you know, and that's something that can't be rushed. And that's something that we have to deal with. Because we're taught like in our culture that if you want to be happy, like you can find it on the shelf. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy. When in reality, the things that make us most happy aren't instantaneous, right? And they're very messy. You know, human relationships, they're very messy. They can be very awkward, but they can also be very rewarding and they can be the most rewarding, right? But you can't rush all the messiness, you know, all the disorganization that comes with a relationship of any kind, right? Friends or marriages or anything like that.
I mean, so Yeah, we all have those friends or like those colleagues or those acquaintances where it's just light and easy. You have a couple laughs, maybe have a beer, but they're forgettable. What are the people's moments that really matter? It's whenever you have like crazy suffering or fear or like you're going through like crazy transcendent moments together. You remember those. And so why is it that humanity holds so hard to those things, you know, as opposed to like just comfort and ease? We don't really care that much about that. If I wrote an entire novel of me sitting around playing Xbox, occasionally getting something to eat and sitting back, I would not sell a single copy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That'd be, it'd be tough.
So there's something about humanity about us. We search for the transcendent, the suffering, the painful things, the things that make us feel more.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that's really fun about writing the book is okay, you've searched, you've strove, you've lived a full life, and guess what? It starts again. What happens now? And not only that, but all of the concepts and ideas that you've had on your back that you've made assumptions about the world are stripped away. So what does the world look like now? What does consciousness look like now? And you got to read the book to find out what I think, but it's a lot of fun.
Good. And people totally should. So I'm going to switch gears just a little bit.
Sure.
And ask you, who are your big inspirations for writing and your big inspirations for the style of writing that you chose to do?
So, oh man, there's so many great ones. I love Tolkien's world building ability. You know, Arthur Rimbaud, the French poet, his way in which to approach the world is hilarious and fantastic. Like he literally died for his art. But as far as like story creation, as far as like meaning, I got to go with Chinua Achebe. Things Fall Apart is a novel from Chinua Achebe that's considered like be the paramount post-colonial novel from Nigeria. And his whole book was a collection of moments in this life of this, you know, leader of a clan called Okonkwo, who is forced to contend with a invasion, as it will, of this European ideology and group that he knows little to nothing about. And his entire world has to be turned to approach that. And if you don't approach it and if you don't deal with it, things fall apart instead. You can't simply hold on to and accept that things will just remain normal if you look away from change. And so his Achebe's whole piece was about, you know, what does it look like whenever two things collide and your whole world is forced to alter? And that idea and philosophy really inspired a lot of my own thinking around this book.
Well, I feel like that's a part that has to come to everybody's life a lot. And those are the things that are sacred. Like because eventually you hit like whatever you want to call it, like rock bottom, you hit the wall. I mean, one day I always tell this to people. I'm like, you've got to be able to have some kind of foundation, you know, philosophically or spiritually, whatever word you want to use, because I'm comfortable with both. But I always say that, like, if you don't have some kind of base like that, like, you are on purpose going to get rocked, and how you deal with that will affect, like, your entire life. Are you comfortable with the idea of death and suffering and pain? And with that comfortability, or at least acceptance, comes the ability to meet it head on, or are you going to find distractions, right? And the problem with distractions is that it doesn't get dealt with and it never goes away.
It doesn't. And so, right, it does not. Like you can look away and the thing just gets bigger. And so in the book, Things Fall Apart, the influence of this completely new culture slowly starts to take over the entire village that Okonkwo was like a leader in. And rather than the people dealing with it and like maintaining their own cultural identity, instead it gets overrun in such a way that their stories can't be represented. And so Achebe had this famous quote. It's actually a proverb, which is, until lions have stories of their own, history will always take the point of view of the hunter, right? And so it's this idea of truly exploring all aspects and points of view so that no story is left out. And I just was really inspired by that guy. He's just awesome writer, awesome poet. It's just really, really cool.
Oh, that's way cool, man. I'll have to check that out. Cause you're right. It's just, you just get a totally different idea. And I feel like that's one thing we can all work better on is getting the stories, you know what I mean? Because I always said, you know, there's that old, Buddhist, you know, is it a proverb or story or whatever they go, but it's the arrows, right? Like in everybody, there's two sides to every story. Mm-hmm. There's what actually happened and there's what you think happened about what happened. Right. Yeah. Like your perspective, like, man, I got shot. Like, it's like, okay, you got shot with an arrow. Right. And there's the story. That's just it. Right. The story of what happened is you got shot with an arrow. And then the other story is what you tell yourself about why you got shot with an arrow.
Yep.
And that's what, you know, it's just tough, right? Like sometimes you just got to just deal with what's going on and not really worry about why. And then on the flip side of that, you know, getting all sides of the story to understand what actually happened. It's crazy, man. That quote you shared, that proverb you shared was fantastic.
You just get to put
people in perspective.
It reminds me that stories need to be told, right? Any people who are thinking about writing a book that are listening to your podcast, write it. Send it to me. I'll read it. I will. Your story deserves to be told just as much as mine. Just as much as Dalton's, like, let it out, right? Become a part of the human condition in such a way that, like, it continues on. And that's the other thing that's really cool about writing a book is that at some point I'll be done, right? I'll fade into the dust or I'll move to Dara, whatever happens. But my book will be around, right? And so that's also it's a really cool concept and idea to think about is that if your idea continues onward, a part of you does as well. And so if you're afraid of death and you're afraid of not existing, put something that matters into the world and that leaves your mark. And so a part of you will continue as well. And just something to think about. I think about that a lot.
I do too, man. And I think that and that's one of the reasons, you know, I decided to do this whole podcast was to help people share their story in a long form way. Cause I love, you know, you get to read an author's book and you get to see a business owner's business and an entrepreneur's creation, right? Or a painter's painting. But there's so many cool things we can learn from these creators and artists when you just get to sit them down and ask these kinds of questions, because, you know, I'm sure everybody's going to love your book, but there's something special about hearing the backstory and why you did it and why you decided to actually come forward. You know, and there was a lot of cool things that you mentioned. I think you mentioned one really cool thing was for, like, you said you were an English teacher and for your students to see something too, man, that's powerful. You know, to see someone you look up to and being able to be like, hey, he wrote a book and I can do something, right?
It's the idea that if you're going to stand in front of a group of people and pretend to be an authority, you should have some sort of experience in your content. You know what I mean? Like, you need to.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if I was about to get surgery and this guy comes and be like, listen, man, I've done 8 years of medical school. I've never touched another human body. I've got the idea down. I'd be like, get out of here. Don't touch me. I'm out.
Well, right? And that's why doctors have to go through so much residency before they can do that, you know?
So I think teaching should be the same way, right? Like, if you're going to sit and teach some kids, you better be willing to bring your truth forward. Be like, yes, this is why this book is cool. And this is why the metaphors are important. This is why, you know, this person is really, you know, good at character development. It's because I wrote a thing and I can tell you through having to research that this person's characters are top notch. You know, I think that's just, it's a better way of approaching in my
opinion. Well, it's a great way to approach teaching or coaching because it allows you to focus on, like, when I think back on some of my best teachers, like some of my best teachers, you know, like I ended up going to school for accounting. But I have a physics teacher that was in middle school with me that I never forgot. And even though I don't, like, physics wasn't my thing, he taught us how to problem solve because he was like an actual you know, he was a physicist. And what was cool was he taught us how to problem solve, because it's not about like knowing how to do something in theory. It's about working through all the mess that's inevitably going to come up when you start working on this. You know what I mean? And as an English teacher, like doing so much research on a book like this and then being able to go teach your students, you know, there's something special about that. Like, hey, I know, actually do know how hard it is to research, you know, and these are some tips that like are real that I can do. You know what I mean? I think that's pretty cool. I think that's way cool.
It's fun. It really is. And you also get like a deep appreciation for some of the best writers out there.
Yeah,
man. Some people are just so incredible. Like,
yeah, they're gifted.
You get almost irritated whenever you like, you write your own stuff and you're like, okay, I think this is pretty good. And then you read something like, you read Gaiman and you're like, okay. Let me go back and edit this again. Hit this one more time.
Yeah.
God bless.
But that's beautiful though, because you have so many mentors and you have these ways of looking at things that I do the same thing, you know, I love speaking and podcasting and video and all these things. And so I have like a lot of people that I like study how they interview. Well, cause it changes the way, like you said, it changes the way you read. Like once you're writing a book, it changes how you read. Like you like, oh my gosh. Yeah. Dude, I know how much that took. That's crazy that he, you know, put these together. Like a whole new light comes on when you actually study these things. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. One of my favorite storytellers. And here's the other thing before I tell that, like you find your inspirations in like the weirdest places. Like I love I love storytelling. One of my favorite storytellers is Dave Chappelle. Like,
yes,
that dude knows how to tell a story. And to everybody else, you know, who doesn't realize that, it's a joke, right? And it's a good joke and he's really funny and it's a good skit and everything. But when you hear how he tells this story and like all these different things, like for me, I'm like, holy cow.
It's like being in a car, right? And if it's like, you know, a little bit and it's this beautiful Shelby and it's like really pretty, you get in, it drives good, right?
Right.
If you know how the car is supposed to run, you pop it open, you just have this complete new fascination and appreciation for all of the mechanics and how everything's tuned just right.
Right.
And it's like telling a story. Like Chappelle, he can set up a joke by providing like context super organically.
Yeah.
He's making you laugh. He's drawing you in.
Right.
His crescendo point is like this crazy, like just right turn and you're just surprised and you're laughing. And so it's a funny joke. But like you said, if you know how to write it, like you're also trying to write a story or tell one, like, man, that development was beautiful, right?
Yeah.
That execution was incredible.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Stuff, and that's why, you know, that's, you know, and so somebody that I look up to in that realm is him. But I think because like you said, like when you actually start doing what you want to do and learning from people who do it, you start to see things differently. And so, yeah. So going back to the whole point of the book and everything, like when you have that purpose, when you have the meaning behind it, like your doors really start to open up and you really start to have things click. And I think that's great. I think it's crazy, man.
I think if somebody feels and sits with the fact that they're going to pass, I think art is much better. I think food tastes better. I think that your companionship with your person is better. Like everything is just a better thing because you're realizing that it can be done.
Yeah.
And so if you start just like taking it for granted, sit for 30 seconds and think to yourself, at some point there will be no more seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll realize like your mom's meatloaf ain't that bad.
because it's not about so weird. Yeah, well, because it's not about like the meatloaf anymore, right?
No.
It's about a deeper thing. And I'm totally with you. I'm totally with you on that page. So tell us how people find your book, when it comes out, all that good stuff.
So the easiest thing to do is you want to follow me on Twitter at Sam Kane Writer.
Okay.
That's also my Instagram handle. You can also go to facebook.com/Sam Kane Author. The book is set to release early 2021. pre-sales will be coming out soon. As soon as you see it, please click the link. My sister actually designed the cover, and it is incredible. Oh, wow. When you see it, it is next level. You can also go to sagestower.com whenever pre-sales go live and go that way as well. And make sure to like and subscribe.
Dude, you're amazing. Thank you so much for spending time with me. Thank you so much for sharing your book, and everybody's got to get it. And that was great, dude. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Take it easy, man.
All right. Thanks.